Lecture 9, The Origins and Rise of Jainism.
Many people inside India and around the world value nonviolence highly. Nonviolence remains one of the most prominent, essential, and admirable elements in Indian culture and society. Indeed, over 2,500 years ago, India developed Jainism, a religious tradition that values absolute nonviolence toward all living beings. Jainism developed and survived in a dynamic context. We have seen how by 500 BCE, social, religious, political, and economic developments in many Indian regions created evolving conditions. Society grew more complex and stresses developed among competing classes. Over the previous 1,000 years, the sacred Vedas had become more ritualized as their ancient form of the Sanskrit language remained frozen and preserved, even as the spoken language of most people in India changed over time. Wherever the Vedic culture rose to dominance, the concept gradually emerged that humans should be classed into 4 social orders or varnas: the priestly Brahman, warrior Kshatriya, productive Vaishya, and serving Shudra. Many local social groupings also emerged, each more specifically associated with a particular traditional occupation called a jati, which literally means birth group. Centuries later, outsiders tried to understand and identify these different but related social models with a misleading Portuguese-derived term, caste. Over time, Brahmanic rituals, including animal sacrifices associated with the sacred Vedas, became more elaborate. Especially in North and Central India, Brahmins sought to use their control over the Vedic texts and sacrifices to claim and support their own position as ritually highest in society. Yet Brahmins were generally not the most politically powerful or wealthy. In many regions, kingship by Rajas, either as war leaders or as hereditary sovereigns, appeared. Kshatriyas customarily valued martial skills and deportment, thus following their Varna's Dharma, or code for conduct. Some Kshatriya individuals and families claimed hereditary kingship over one or more regions. Others established their clans as landholders and served as warriors. With their political power and wealth, many Kshatriyas patronized Brahmins as hired priests or tending courtiers. This sometimes led to competition between Brahmins and Kshatriyas for leadership in society. Meanwhile, commerce based on artisanal production and raw material extraction also expanded, both within each region, but also among various differently endowed regions. Cities grew in size and wealth, so an urban culture emerged. Among Vaishyas, some profited from the growing commerce and grew wealthy, valuing their own mercantile expertise above the priestly or martial ways of life. Many Vaishyas also hired Brahmins to perform rituals for them and gave money to Kshatriyas, either willingly as loans for profit or more reluctantly as taxes or protection money. But the Vedic system, which ranked Vaishyas lower by birth than the first 2 Varnas, did not always seem attractive or persuasive to them. Instead, some Vaishyas looked for other religions that gave more respect to their mercantile values and ways of life. The majority of the population, designated in the Vedic model as Shudras, was the most diverse. But they were classed by Brahmins as the lowest ranking among the 4 Varnas. Some served as agriculturalists, artisans, or servants. But some enterprising or fortunate Shudra families rose to considerable power and wealth through warfare or commerce. The names of Shudra warlords and even kings began to appear in historical evidence from this period. This was even more the case in South India, where Shudras were the vast majority of the population at almost all socioeconomic levels, while members of the top 3 Varnas were relatively few. Some of these upwardly mobile Shudras also found the Vedic system less persuasive, so they were open to new religious movements that would allow them more prestige. ranked in the Vedic model even below Shudras, were so-called outcasts and Adivasis. These were substantial numbers of people, but they were largely marginalized by the dominant Vedic culture. Further, women in every community, every family, customarily stood behind their menfolk. They too were looking for other religions that permitted them more scope for advancement. All these social, economic, and political changes meant that individuals and groups within each region changed their roles and their expectations for themselves and for others. They grasped new opportunities for upward mobility. This intensified rivalries between established and rising communities. Each part of each society in each region responded somewhat differently, but broad patterns can be discerned for the general period around 500 BCE. In this lecture, we will explore one of the leading new alternative religious movements, and it was a moral model of and for the universe and human society that challenged established Brahmanic Vedic order. This was Jainism, the religion of the conquerors, though through nonviolence. From its origins in the 6th century BCE, Jainism has continued as an important social and religious community in India until today. In the next lecture, we will consider yet another major alternative model that developed in India out of these same processes and during the same period, and that is Buddhism. Jain philosophers and teachers explored and advanced a religious and social model that aspired to total nonviolence, ahimsa. At the core of Jainism is the concept of the jiva, a hard-to-translate term that we can approximate with the awkward term life monad. That is, a distinct living entity that exists regardless of the physical body it inhabits. Your jiva is you, but your jiva has been born in the world before, sometimes as a human being, sometimes as an animal, sometimes as a divinity, sometimes as a tiny insect. Jain philosophers speculated that there were 8,400,000 different levels of births, each ranked in order from imperceptible motes of dust floating in the air up to divinities. What then determines the kind of body into which your jiva is born? Jains teach that your karma, meaning the deeds or actions that you perform in one birth, decides the level of birth in your next incarnation. For Jains, karma is a particulate substance, especially something produced by violence of any type. Some actions are so bad in karmic terms, like the killing of another jiva, that they are very substantial. Other actions are less violent, like violent thoughts, so the bad karmic matter they produce is more subtle. The karma you do sticks to your jiva, weighing it down in metaphysical terms, leading to your lower birth. As a metaphor, we can think of the jiva as an invisible sphere. When karmic matter sticks to it, the sphere becomes heavier, more material, and sinks down in the next birth. How then can a person get rid of the karma that attaches to his or her jiva? Well, the process of living in this world burns off some karma. So people, animals, divinities, and other beings who, on balance, burn off more karma than they produce through violence, will move a little higher in the next life. There are some ways of living that do little or no violence, and so generate little or no new bad karmic matter. Doing austerities like voluntarily taking on and enduring suffering burns off even more karma. The metaphorical sphere becomes lighter and rises in the next life. Ultimately, in the Jain tradition, a truly nonviolent person can burn off all of the karmic matter attached to the jiva, and so escape from the cycle of birth, death, rebirth, and redeath that makes up this manifest world around us. The jiva itself is demanifested and no longer exists. According to the Jain tradition, that is emically, there were 24 model Jains who in the past have achieved this escape. They are known as the heroic Tirthankara, or ford crossers, whose jiva has gone long beyond this world into the total stillness beyond it. That state of absolute transcendence and peace is described by the concept of nirvana. The metaphor often used to convey the ethereal concept of nirvana is a candle flame. In this world, every passing puff of wind, no matter how gentle, makes the candle flame bob about. But what becomes of the flame once it's gone from this earthly existence? Can anything in the material world affect it anymore? So the ultimate goal of each jhana is to emulate the death-conquering Tirthankaras and thus liberate his or her jiva from all karma and therefore from this manifest existence by achieving the condition of nirvana. The last of the 24 Tirthankara remains particularly relevant for many jhanis. Many jhana sources, both philosophical and artistic, present an emic history of this last Tirthankara. He is known to his followers as Mahavira, the great hero, for his conquest over violence. He was famously born sometime between 600 and 540 BCE to a Kshatriya family. But even from his conception, through his gestation, and in his birth, he remained totally nonviolent. While in the womb, he never even kicked his mother, nor did he cause her any labor pain. Likewise, during his youth, he did not follow the warrior dharma of his family, but rather lived nonviolently without generating any more karmic matter. Then, at age 30, Mahavira renounced his family and the rest of the world to become an ascetic. He did austerities and let his clothing fall away from him, symbolic of his letting go of this material world. He ate only the minimum amount of food, and only food that did not contain a jiva, for example, grain that had not yet sprouted and so had no life. He meditated peacefully to gain insight into the true nature of existence. Mahavira's followers took the collective title Jina, meaning conquerors of this world through nonviolence, from which comes the name Jain for their religion and community. Some of Mahavira's most devoted followers sought to emulate him and other Tirthankaras by achieving escape from this necessarily violent world. So he organized those who became fully committed to this birth, the liberation, into a sangha or monastic order. Even today, Jain monks and nuns follow Mahavira's teachings as part of the sangha. Many cover the mouth and nose with a fine cloth so as not to breathe in the smallest jiva suspended in the air. They eat only the most purely non-living foods, and never in the dark when an unperceived insect might be consumed inadvertently. Drinking water is strained to remove all living things from it. When walking, these monks and nuns gently sweep the ground before them so as not to step on any living being. Some monks became scholars or philosophers and dedicated themselves to copying the sacred texts of Jainism or the learned commentaries of leading Jain teachers. All these were highly regarded nonviolent practices. Even today, some of the leading book publishers in India are Jain. Most of Mahavira's followers over the centuries have remained in society, living his lessons as far as they were able to do by adhering to the five Jain vows. As the primary vow, Mahavira, like the other Tirthankaras, taught how to live nonviolently. Above all, a true Jain must avoid killing any jivas. This means a complete vegetarian diet. But this also means that no Vedic sacrifices in which various foods or other substances are poured into a sacred fire's offerings. In Jain eyes, this inevitably causes violence. Certainly, the martial dharma of Kshatriyas, which Mahavira himself repudiated, is to be rejected. Even some occupations associated with Shudras, like farming or fishing, require the killing of animals, plants, and fish. But Jainism is compatible with the way of life of some Vaishyas and other merchants who can live peacefully selling and exchanging goods. But violence can come in many other forms than just killing. The other four Jain vows are to avoid falsehood, theft, ostentatious pride in one's possessions, and unchastity. Jain merchants and other men and women in similar occupations can follow these five Jain vows relatively easily, at least to some degree, as laymen and laywomen. A society in which there's no lying, theft, or other violence favors families with growing wealth to protect. The vows against ostentation and sexual impropriety also conform with bourgeois values around the world, including those in ancient India. One may have great wealth, but it's improper and often dangerous to display it in public, especially if one is not willing or able to defend that wealth or one's womenfolk by force. Sexual promiscuity also violates the moral values found in many societies. Metaphysically, jains improve the condition of their jivas to the extent that they live up to these five jain vows. With less karmic matter attached to the jiva, they will be born higher in the next incarnation, better able to adhere to these jain vows. Mahavira himself lived for 40 years as an ascetic, spreading his teachings about nonviolence. Finally, he chose to burn off the last of his karma and thereby enable his jiva to achieve transcendence. He stood unmoving and therefore not disturbing even the microscopic jivas around him. He stopped eating or drinking anything, fasting away his remaining karmic matter. Finally, his jiva escaped his diminished physical body, never to be reborn again, having achieved nirvana. The dating of this release varies between 527 BCE and 468 BCE, and is traditionally located in the lower Gangetic region of Magadha. In the Jain human social order, therefore, there are three levels. Highest are the ascetic members of the Sangha, committed fully to nonviolence. Next are the lay people who follow the Jain path as best they can, perhaps joining the Sangha later in life. But below these are people who do not follow Jain teachings, who live lives based on violence, including Brahmin, priests, Kshatriya warriors, and any Vaishyas, Shudras, outcasts, and Adivasis who live or profit from some form of killing or other violence. When considering the Jain movement from an outsider, Edic perspective, we can see many reasons why Jainism has continued in India from its foundation down until today. While there's very limited historical evidence about the first 23 other Tirthankaras, we have much more source material about Mahavira. He was roughly contemporary with Gautama the Buddha, as we will see in the next lecture. The 6th to 5th century BCE was clearly a period of intellectual, cultural, social, economic, and political ferment in India that produced these great moral leaders and their dynamic religious movements. These competing movements vied for the hearts and minds of similar pools of potential followers. Mahavira not only repudiated the sacredness of the Veda and its Varna social order, he and his followers also reached out to the many non-Sanskrit speakers. Many Jain teachings were in one of the Prakrits, the regional languages of North and Central India. These languages had developed from Sanskrit, but were spoken by the common people. This did away with the near monopoly of access to sacred religious texts that Brahmins used to support their own ritually high status. Over time, Jain teachers adapted popular folk stories that made them accessible and attractive to men and women. In one Jain parable, Princess Maravati's excessively proud father, the king, asks his assembled courtiers, quote, "Do you think there's another monarch on earth who has so much material prosperity, illustrious court, and gifted kinsmen as I have?" While all of the other attending courtiers fawningly declare him unequaled in the universe, his daughter, Maravati, truthfully dissents, saying, "Sire, whatever the courtiers have stated is stark flattery, a total violation of truth. On this earth, there are many monarchs who are in possession of an equivalent treasure, court, and kinsmen." She adds that such material possessions should not be sources of pride anyway. The king at first overlooks her dissent and repeats his overweening claims. Again, Maravati is the only one in his court to dissent, saying, "Wealth and poverty, good and evil occurrences are all the outcome of one's own karma beyond the power of the king to affect." Furious, the king decides to prove his power over Mairavati by marrying her to the poorest, lowliest, and sickest man in his kingdom. The story says his ears were rotten, his nose dull and flat, his lips long and projected, his cheeks marked by depression. His body was all bones and no flesh, with distinct marks of leprosy. Mairavati, firm in her conviction that her own karma determines her future, calmly accepts this husband. When even he takes pity and offers to release her from marriage, she responds, quote, "When sins are up, one is born as a woman. And for a woman to give up purity is more sinful. Youth, beauty, wealth, these come and go, but purity is a rarest acquisition. You may be rich or poor, well or ill, but you, my husband, are my all." Even when the guardian deity of the kingdom offers her a young and handsome groom instead, Mairavati remains faithful to her husband. Suddenly, her husband throws off his leprous body and resumes his true form as a divine king who has been searching for a pure woman to reward by making her his queen. This divine husband then forces Mairavati's father to submit and to dress as a humble peasant before being forgiven for his baseless pride. Thus, having received the fruits of her good karma, Mairavati devotes the rest of her life to Jain spiritual practices. Such a parable showing an idealized woman fulfilling her moral duty would appeal to many women and men, giving them great incentive to practice Jainism. Such teachings were also explicit or implicit competition with other movements, since they often showed non-Jains, including Kshatriya kings, Brahmin priests, and Vedic divinities, in a negative light. We can see why the rising social class of merchants who profited from the growing commerce of that period, but whose status in the Varna model was relatively low, would find the Jain religion convincing and attractive. We have already seen how merchants in particular trades like jewelers or cloth or grain wholesalers organized themselves into guilds. This provided such merchants with social groupings or jatis that collectively found the practices and values of Jainism attractive. Also, Jain philosophers advanced some of the more esoteric metaphysics of the pattern of the late Vedic Upanishads that were still being composed by Brahmin thinkers. But Jain scholars pursued this abstract knowledge to advance their own movement's understanding of the world, based on ultimate nonviolence. What resulted were theoretically sophisticated debates over the nature and meaning of the universe, where each school of thought and religion challenged the others to new philosophical and metaphysical heights. These debates involved Brahmins, Jains, and also Buddhists, as we'll discuss in the next lecture. Jains taught the futility of living for this world and its apparent pleasures while ignoring the true transitory nature of one's earthly existence. One visual lesson depicts, in morality terms, a man hanging by two ropes high up in a tree. Above him, a beehive slowly drips honey onto his tongue, which is his sole focus. Hence, he does not even notice the black and white rats that are gnawing at the ropes that suspend him over a pit full of vipers. Representing the days and nights of his life, these rats soon will plunge him into a painful death below. But oblivious to this impending end to his body, the man thinks only about the sweet, sensual pleasure of the honey. This often reproduced image, therefore, is a metaphor for human existence and a lesson about the need to transcend it. So powerful was this image of life's impermanence that other religious teachers also used it, including Brahmins and Buddhists. Artists also created ways to represent Mahavira and the other Tirthankaras, and also Jain moral and philosophical lessons. Some of these images are cut into the walls of caves where Jain ascetics live. Others are in the homes of Jain laypeople. Since from that early period onward, many of the Indian stonemasons and sculptors evidently worked for patrons of various religious traditions and communities, these images show Mahavira and other Tirthankaras with many of the same features as the Buddha and other sacred beings. Often, Tirthankara has behind his head a sun-like radiant halo, or the overarching and protecting hood of a many-headed cobra. These form umbrella-like symbols of sovereignty, not just in the material world, but over the entire cosmos as well. Tirthankara conventionally has extended earlobes, showing how they were stretched down during his affluent youth by the golden jeweled earrings. But these distended earlobes are now empty, showing that he abandoned these jeweled earrings along with the rest of his worldly wealth. His hair is customarily shown in short curls, looking almost like stylized snails. Most images show them wearing no clothing, having abandoned that as well. Since the Tirthankaras all ended their jiva's existence with total nonviolence, they are not conventionally portrayed as active, but rather in a meditating or unmoving pose. Later images show vines growing up around their legs, so long have they stood motionless. A few of the most prominent statues of Mahavira and giant saints were created by carving away the tops of rock hills, producing monolithic statues. One nearly 60 feet tall, carved in the 10th century, represents such a giant saint. Periodically, the most prominent of these images is bathed in milk, ghee, vermilion, and precious spices, with wealthy giants showing their devotion by bidding against each other to sponsor this ritual. Giant ascetics, having given up all material wealth, prostrate themselves before it. More recently, artists have tried to convey the transcendence of the Tirthankara by depicting his absence. In these images, the figure of the Tirthankara is an empty void, with only surrounding frame suggesting his outline. Over the centuries since Mahavira, the Jain movement spread beyond its original heartland in the central Gangetic plain. The oldest part of this tradition shifted its center to Western India, today the regions of Rajasthan and Gujarat. These were commercial centers where Jain merchants flourished. Then a branch of the Jain movement extended into South India, bringing in Dravidian-speaking peoples. Gradually, from around the 4th century BCE onward, cultural and metaphysical differences developed between these two branches. The South Indian branch believes it has remained closer to what it preserved as the original teachings of Mahavira himself. Known as the Digambara, or sky-clad branch, its monks abandoned all clothing, as did Mahavira. This branch does not permit women to become nuns and therefore also reject clothing. The northern branch, known as Shvetambara, meaning white-clad, feels it has developed according to the essence of Jainism. In this branch, both monks and nuns are permitted, and they wear unstitched and therefore pure, simple, white robes. There are also subtle philosophical and political differences between these two branches. Although it has always centered on merchants, Jainism has attracted men and women from other ways of life as well. The founder of the Mauryan dynasty, Chandragupta, who created the first major Indian empire by 320 BCE, is claimed by Jains as a convert to their religion. He's remembered for trying to reconcile the northern and southern branches of Jainism. And other sectarian differences within that tradition were also resolved. Further, Chandragupta is credited with renouncing his empire and his entire world late in life, and then starving his body to death in the ideal Jain way. Today, Jains total fewer than 5 million people, comprising only a tiny 0.4% of the population of India. Another 1 or 2 million Jains live outside of India. Occasionally, Indian newspapers celebrate the renunciation of a rich Jain merchant who scatters all his material wealth and takes on the monastic life, or a Jain ascetic who starves himself to death out of devotion to the Jain path. Many of these historical changes during the broad period around 500 BCE that generated Jainism also led to Buddhism, but the trajectories of Jainism and Buddhism differed as they interacted with each other and with the developing Brahmanic tradition. Our next lectures will look at these processes and also the ways that Jainism and Buddhism related to political developments, especially India's first great empire.